This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Press headlines. President Putin calls on the Russian defense industry to increase its weapon production to meet the needs of the army for the war in Ukraine. The U.S. House of Representatives approves a new $45 billion aid package for Ukraine. This will bring Washington's aid to Kiev to almost $100 billion. Also ahead, airlines cancel thousands of flights in the U.S. as a massive winter storm disrupts airport operations. Thank you for joining us. Our top story, Russia's president urges the country's defense industry to increase its production to meet the needs of forces fighting in Ukraine. Vladimir Putin has told the industry's chiefs to make sure that the army receives the military equipment in the shortest possible time. He made the remarks during a visit to a weapon manufacturing center. Putin also said the industry should improve the technical quality of the equipment. This comes as Western countries, especially the U.S., have been supplying Ukraine with billions of dollars worth of advanced weapons since the beginning of the war in February. The U.S. House of Representatives, meanwhile, has approved a $45 billion aid package for Ukraine. The military and economic assistance is part of a $1.6 trillion government funding bill that has passed the Senate. It will now go to U.S. President Joe Biden to be signed into law. The U.S. has been Ukraine's main military sponsor in the war with Russia. It has already sent aid worth around $50 billion to Ukraine this year. Russia has repeatedly warned that foreign military aid for Ukraine will only drag out the war and escalate the human suffering. The war in Ukraine has plunged the Moscow-Washington ties to their lowest point in decades. Russia's ambassador to the U.S. has compared the state of the relations to an ice age, warning of the high risk of a clash. And turning elsewhere, Russia's foreign minister has called for de-escalation in the Nagorno-Karabakh region. That's after the only link between the region and Armenia was blocked by a group of Azerbaijani activists. Lavrov says he hopes that movement along the key road will be restored as soon as possible. He made the remarks following talks with his Azerbaijani counterpart in Moscow. The corridor, which is a key supply route for food, medicine and fuel, has been obstructed since last week by a group styling itself as environmental activists. Armenia says they are backed by the Azerbaijani government to create a humanitarian crisis in the mountainous enclave. Baku, however, accuses Russian peacekeepers of closing the road link. The Azerbaijan Republic regained control of the disputed region after a 2021 war with Armenia. From nurses to teachers to railway employees, British workers in various sectors have been staging back-to-back walkouts since the summer. And now, air travellers in the country are warned of delays as passport control staff go on strike ahead of Christmas. The Public and Commercial Services Union says over 1,000 Border Force staff walked out of their jobs on Friday. This is the first day of their industrial action, which is due to last until New Year, as they are dissatisfied with their pay, demanding raises. According to the union, the government's 2% raise offer doesn't keep pace with a double-digit inflation in the country. The industrial unrest is expected to upend travel plans in the coming days. Britain's busiest airport, Heathrow, says passengers should be prepared for travel disruptions. The UK is reeling from strikes over pay and working conditions, and that's amid a cost of living crisis combined by fears of a recession.
2022 has been dominated by a cost of living crisis, and the figures are staggering. Inflation is running at a double-digit pace, the highest in 40 years, and far outpacing wage growth. While food prices have shot up almost 20%, and the cost of heating a typical home has jumped more than 150%. As temperatures plummet below zero and desperation rises, key sector worker unions have launched mass strike actions to pressure the government to force wage rises.
The people who are out here on strike today are the same people who not only worked through the pandemic, we worked for the people. We'd get their prescriptions, we'd get their milk and bread.
We just want a pay rise in line with the cost of living. At the moment, what we're getting is actually in terms of a pay cut. So it's not even in line with inflation. Everything's gone up. We're just like everybody else. We're all struggling.
This is not about pay. This is about our jobs.
The situation has become so dire in Britain that many families will have to choose whether to heat their homes or feed their families this Christmas.
It is very distressing. It's a situation which, in a way, unimaginable for a country which is supposed to be one of the richest countries in Europe and in the West. Why is it we have these extremes of poverty? Why are people, some people, forced to choose between heating and eating? I mean, there's something completely wrong about our system. We should be plugging and supporting and promoting equality and, not oppressing the poor. You know, there's something which says a lot about our political system, which is flawed.
The government has pinned much of the blame on economic recovery from the COVID era. However, critics say its ruling Conservative Party incompetence and leadership instability that has also left the economy in a dire state. A lesser discussed reason for a European-wide crisis is the ongoing Ukraine war. Britain has remained a staunch supporter of continued fighting, even upping its shipments of arms and financial support.
I think the first is ensuring that we deliver more military aid and that that military aid evolves to meet the situation that we're now facing. And that means more air defence systems, it means artillery, it means armoured vehicles. For our part in the United Kingdom, we've pledged to match or exceed the £2.3 billion in aid that we provided this year, next year.
Low wages, higher fuel costs, inflation and major strike action have all marred 2022. Does the government have what it takes to resolve these many issues in 2023? Probably not. It's going to be a long road with most likely higher taxation, major cuts in public spending and renewed pressure on an already struggling British working class. Robert Carter, London.
Now, police have clashed with protesters in the French capital, Paris, after a deadly shooting with a suspected racist motive on a Kurdish center. Protesters gathered near the site of the shooting, hurling stones at the police. Security forces fired tear gas and attempted to disperse the crowd. French President Emmanuel Macron called the shooting an odious attack. The Interior Minister has reinforced police protection of Kurdish community sites in Paris and elsewhere across the country. A 69-year-old has been arrested in connection with the shooting, which killed three people and injured three others. The suspect was known to authorities and had a history of racism and attacks on foreign nationals, especially the Kurds. Thousands of flights have been cancelled in the US as a massive winter storm brings airport operations down to a crawl. Nearly 7,000 flights were cancelled on Friday and Thursday, leaving holiday travelers frustrated. The Federal Aviation Administration imposed ground stops and delays to de-ice a number of airport runways as a result of these storms. Some 4,000 US flights were also delayed on Friday. Poor weather conditions have also disrupted railroad travel in the holiday season, forcing the cancellation of dozens of trains. A U.S. congressional committee probing the 2021 attack on the Capitol has unveiled its final report incriminating former President Donald Trump. In the latest edition of our News Review program, we discussed the report and its implication on Trump's bid for re-election. Let's take a quick listen to that.
On this segment of the program, a U.S. congressional panel probing the 2021 attack on the Capitol building has released its final report. It accuses former President Donald Trump of inciting the deadly riots and engaging in a conspiracy to overturn the 2020 election results. The 800-page report is based on more than 1,000 interviews and hundreds of thousands of documents, as well as federal and state court rulings. The report indicates that former President knew he had lost the election, but still pressured officials and his deputy against the vote outcome. He then directly summoned what the committee calls a violent mob and refused to ask his supporters to leave. The report is made public just days after the panel asked the Justice Department to charge Trump for four crimes, including obstruction and insurrection. It's the first time Congress has referred a former president to criminal prosecution in U.S. history. Trump dismisses the committee and its report as a political witch hunt. Well, joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have our correspondent Colin Campbell, who's joining us from Washington, also from Madison. We have editor Veterans Today, Kevin Barrett. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. It's Kevin Barrett, if you may. What are the implications of this report? As Colin mentioned, it's nothing new, but now that it's all in writing, it could make a difference.
Well, I think Colin's right that Trump probably has more people against him than for him at this point. And some of those people on the Republican side will be stealth opponents. They won't be actively, openly working against him, but they, again, as Colin said, they'd like him to go away. And then, of course, then there's the Liz Cheney faction of Republicans who are vociferously anti-Trump, the never-Trumpers. So, yeah, I think he's now in the minority in Washington. In a sense, he always was. Trump was an outsider president, and that's part of the reason this happened. He's viewed as a disruptive outsider by the permanent national security state, and it's regardless of what you think about many of his decisions and actions, quite a few of which were completely crazy. He did shake things up in Washington and paid the price. And now we have an extreme polarization going on in the electorate and in the country in general, where the narratives that we're getting are not very factual on both sides. We're getting this story of the insurrection from the committee and its supporters, when in fact what really happened was that 99%+ of the people there were peaceful demonstrators who were concerned about the election integrity issue, which actually is a huge issue. And indeed, there's a very strong case that a number of American presidential elections have indeed been stolen, most obviously 2000, when a bunch of Republican thugs terrorized the vote counters in Florida, and then the Supreme Coup ruled in favor of Bush and Cheney. And then in 2004, most likely, according to all the polls and the best data, Kerry actually won at least a 3-point, possibly as much as a 6-point popular vote mandate and an electoral vote decisive victory, which was stolen from him by Karl Rove's friends, who, like Mike Connell, Karl Rove's election czar, who oversaw what almost certainly was a massive computer vote fraud theft of that election from John Kerry, which Kerry, the skull and bones companion of Bush, was probably okay with. So we have a real problem with our elections in this country. The Democrats have long been in denial about this, even though they're the ones who actually were robbed worse than the Republicans. Historically, people should look at Jonathan Simon's work for the details. So what we have right now is a bizarre situation where suddenly there's a group that's upset about election integrity, and it's the Republicans who've actually, that's the party that's been stealing most of the elections. And then we have the party that says, oh, none of this ever happens, that's, you know, completely in denial, and that's the Democrats. And they're both putting out these mythological narratives that are have very little to do with fact. So I think they're, you know, we're really in a crisis right now in the United States. Belief in the, you know, faith in the political system is at an all-time low. Faith in the media is at an all-time low. And something's got to give. I don't know what it's going to be.
Colin, do you think that this will ultimately lead to Donald Trump being ineligible for the next presidential elections?
Yeah, if he is indicted, it definitely could be. A lot of people feel that's mixed. I mean, there are large implications for indicting a former president. Will this become some type of weaponization of the intelligence agency and, of course, the Department of Justice for future former presidents? There are some implications there. Others say, listen, justice needs to be done here. There were some serious grievances and some serious malfeasance that was accomplished here, and that needs to be taken into consideration and acted upon. And I think that there are more people who think that the latter will be the overlying wisdom here than the former, because if something is not done, this could also send a message for future politicians who want to engage in unlawful practices or unconstitutional actions, and they would go unpunished. So I think that there's a high probability here that the Department of Justice will bring charges, but it's unclear how that will go forward from there.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Press TV's Colin Campbell joining us from Washington, and Kevin Barrett, editor of Veterans Today, joining us from Madison. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review, but stick around, there's plenty more to come.
Palestinian resistance movements, Hamas and Islamic Jihad have slammed the Israeli killing of a young Palestinian man near Tel Aviv. Islamic Jihad pledged that Israeli crimes would never undermine the determination of the Palestinian people to liberate their country. Hamas also emphasized that Palestinian resistance would continue and even escalate until the end of the Israeli occupation and the establishment of a Palestinian state with Al-Quds as its capital. Israeli forces shot dead Naim Badr in the town of Kafr Qasim on Friday. They allege he carried out a car ramming attack, injuring three Israeli troops. The latest killing comes amid heightened tensions between Israeli forces and Palestinians, in particular in the occupied West Bank. Israeli forces have killed over 220 Palestinians in the West Bank and the besieged the Gaza Strip since the beginning of this year. That brings an end to our international bulletin for this hour.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Germany has reportedly cut its reliance on Russian supplies from 55% last year to the current 20%. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of the Russian publication RT noted Germany has cut its reliance on Russian gas by nearly two-thirds compared to last year. Bloomberg reported recently, citing the country's Association of Energy and Water Industries, BDEW. According to the report, the share of Russian gas consumed in Germany has fallen to around 20% this year, from 55% in 2021. This happened amid a significant drop in imports of the Russian fuel to the EU due to sanctions, explosions in September on Russia's Nord Stream gas pipelines, which left them inoperable, and Berlin's moves to diversify supplies. Germany is reportedly short by around 50 billion cubic meters of gas in yearly deliveries as a result of the reduction in Russian supplies. According to BDEW, however, the country has managed to reduce its overall demand by around 15% this year due to mild weather and a campaign to reduce consumption. Germany has compensated for the reduction in Russian supplies by increasing imports from the Netherlands, Belgium, and France, according to BDEW. The country also plans to step up its liquefied natural gas LNG imports. Last week, Germany launched its first floating LNG terminal at the North Sea port of Wilhelmshaven, with another four set to be deployed in the coming month. The planned terminals are expected to give the country an annual LNG import capacity of at least 29.5 BCM, roughly a third of its yearly gas demand of 90.5 BCM. According to Chancellor Olaf Scholz, the terminals will help ensure that Germany's energy supplies do not depend on pipelines from Russia. LNG deliveries, however, are expected to cost much more than Russian pipeline gas. Meanwhile, Politico reported EU countries finally struck a gas price cap deal after months of fraught divisions over a key aspect of the bloc's response to the energy crisis. But the final settlement may end up pleasing no one. Energy ministers meeting in Brussels for their final summit of the year reached political agreements on a so-called market correction mechanism. Under the plan, which is set to come into force on February 15th and last for 1 year, trades on Europe's gas exchanges will be capped at 180 euros per megawatt hour if that price level is reached for 3 working days and European wholesale gas prices are, for the same length of time, 35 euros above the global price of liquefied natural gas LNG. The complex policy tool, which is set well below the 275 euros trigger price originally proposed by the European Commission and applies to month-ahead, 3-month and 1-year contracts, was approved by EU countries with a qualified majority. Hungary opposed, while Austria and the Netherlands abstained. Germany, which had long opposed price cap proposals pushed by an alliance of southern and eastern countries, as well as Belgium, was able to support the scheme, but only with significant safeguards, which address Berlin's concerns that intervening in the European gas market could drive international LNG cargoes away from the continent, just as Europe and Germany in particular is trying to wean itself off its former addiction to Russian gas. The policy was designed to avoid the kinds of price spikes seen in the summer, when prices at Europe's main trading hub, the TTF, briefly hit 345 euros per MWH. Those prices have now cooled considerably to 115 euros per MWH, but remain 4 to 5 times higher than what they averaged before Russia-Ukraine conflicts and threw Europe's gas supply into chaos, piling pressure on domestic consumers and businesses, particularly in energy-intensive sectors like chemicals, steel, and glass. If ever triggered, the cap would, in theory, apply for at least 20 working days. Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni called it a little big victory, while Polish Prime Minister Mateusz Morawiecki said it spells the end. But Dutch Energy Minister Rob Jetten told Politico he was still worried about the measure's impact. The focus should be on lowering gas prices for European consumers while also guaranteeing security of gas supply, he said. I'm not completely convinced this market correction mechanism is beneficial for both those topics. In a sign of how divisive the discussion still remains, a senior diplomat from one pro-cap country said the measure is not enough and only a temporary emergency measure, saying wholesale gas prices are still 4 times higher than normal and a broader market reform was necessary, they said. This gives the impression that we can afford 180 euros per megawatt hour, which we cannot. There are still hurdles in the way of the policy ever coming into force. The European Commission has throughout shared the concerns of the anti-price cap countries about the plan's possible impact on gas supply and market stability. Energy Commissioner Kadri Simpson emphasized in a post-summit press conference that the Commission stands ready to suspend ex ante the activation of the mechanism if a forthcoming report by the EU Markets Watchdog ESMA and the energy regulator ACER, along with analysis by the European Central Bank, shows that the risks overweigh the benefits. The bank has already spoken out about possible risks to market stability. Europe's cold snap this December has seen gas storage levels reduced from near full to 84%. That's still a fairly comfortable level for this time of the year. But how the price cap might interact with the global gas market next spring and summer, when European countries will once again be racing to fill their underground gas storage facilities, will be a question for energy ministers when they meet again in 2023. A new year, but the same energy crisis.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The UK has been accused of a cover-up during the time that they were involved in the Afghanistan war. A new inquiry launched into how the SAS soldiers killed Afghan civilians dated back to the year 2010. Now, what is worse is that this involves more than 50 summary killings by the SAS soldiers. And even worse yet, it came when for years there were reports that elite British troops killed civilians in cold blood, which meant that they were aware of it, authorities higher up. Why was this covered up is the first question, and more importantly, why would the British soldiers do that? Were there orders from the top down? Just a few of the questions we'll be asking our guests in this edition of The Spotlight. First, let me introduce them. Farah Hughes, journalist, author, and activist, joins us from Belfast. Also joining us is Robert Fantina, author and journalist, who joins us from Kitchener, Ontario. Welcome to you both.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Farhiz, I'll first start with you. So we have the nature of the crime, as it's been said, which is much more extensive than this, but this is an inquiry that's being held again on more than 50, what we understand, summary killings by the SAS soldiers, 54, according to what has been revealed. And it happened in Helmand province between the years 2010 and 11, of which the conclusion was that this amounted to war crimes. What is your immediate reaction to this, something, again, that's been reopened to follow through in order to perhaps get some prosecution, if that is at all possible?
Firstly, I don't think there'll be any prosecutions whatsoever. If you consider that this is already a decade after these war crimes and murders, extrajudicial executions have been carried out, and it's only now that the second investigation is underway. The people in Afghanistan will never receive justice. The only justice they had was at the bayonet points of the British soldiers that had gone halfway around the world to oppress and subdue the Afghan people. As you introduced me, I live in Belfast in Ireland, and we all here know about British war crimes. In 1971, on the 9th of August, when the British reintroduced internment without trial, the British paratroopers run amok in Belfast on the 9th of August 1971 and murdered 11 people in what were called the Spring Hill Ballymurphy massacres. The inquests have only taken part last year, 50 years after those people were brutally cut down, people who were unarmed, including
Why does it take so long, though? Why does that take that long for this to be even covered and then, you know, perhaps, again, with, as you said, no prosecution to take place?
Well, it's part of the cover-up. You see, if you don't have an inquest, then there's no accountability as to how the people died. The British government and indeed the British Army claimed that these people were armed, that these were terrorists, that these were insurrectionists, people who died in gun battles, which is all lies, and it's all propaganda and it's all cover-up. And in fact, 6 months after these murders in Belfast, we had 13 unarmed civil rights protesters murdered in Derry on what was called Bloody Sunday on the 30th of January. Right. 1972. And the gentleman who was in charge of that was then later went on to become the general officer commanding of British Land Forces. A soldier one day becomes the general officer commanding several years later after committing war crimes in the streets of Derry.
Okay. Well, I'm going to start out with a general description of a couple of the overview, Robert Fantina, of what was disclosed. And then we're going to get into a couple cases, if not three, if we have the time, of the nature of the crimes that were committed, because that needs to be, unfortunately or fortunately, reviewed here so that you can grasp the gravity of the crime that was committed. First, in terms of the overall view, from the evidence and disclosures required by the court, it says that the Afghan man detained by these SAS soldiers were during night raids, and they were often separated from their families, and they were shot dead. This was routine, where the troops then went and planted weapons on them to justify the crimes. So that's an overall view of what happened. The question is, why would they subscribe, these SAS soldiers, to such a method?
There are a few reasons. One is that they were given orders by their superiors and supervisors to do this, to terrorize the population by killing the men in their, or pulling them out of their homes and killing them. So terrorize the population to subdue them and prevent any kind of resistance to the invading forces could have been ordered by their leaders. The other reason is simply that these soldiers, many soldiers in the United States, UK, and other places, are trained to kill. That is what they do. That is their job. And so they see anybody and they will kill them. They also, there is discrimination against the people of Afghan. Afghanistan is not a Christian country. It's mainly a Muslim country. And in the West, Muslims are seen as different and dangerous. And so the soldiers who are accused of killing, who allegedly killed these civilians, were probably part of or felt that same way, that these people weren't worthy of life the same way as they were, and therefore they were free to kill them. Now, this is what we see in war frequently, so it's nothing new. The fact that it's been exposed or is being investigated after all these years simply tells us that the British government doesn't take it all that seriously.
Well, let's take a look at a more graphic example here. And I'm sorry if it bothers you. I do apologize right now. But Frahius, I'm going to go ahead and ask you anyways, because this is one of the things that is pretty much an eye-opener, where you have an instance of two Afghan children where it is, again, citing this source, at 8 p.m., you have the British and Afghan soldiers. They burst into a home, a 12-year-old boy and a 14-year-old, who were staying there overnight, were taken, and a witness said, "When I entered the room afterwards, I saw bones and teeth all over the place. There were four altogether. The four of them were lying there, blood everywhere." Is that what SAS soldiers are trained to do?
I think brutality goes along with the mindset of people who are trained, specifically these special air service personnel. They're trained not to take prisoners. They're trained to torture people. They're trained to gather information. And they're trained to terrorize the local population. I mean, you don't have to go any further than, was it Abu Ghraib, when you see what happened in the prison with the torture, you know, with prisoners that were naked, that were attacked by dogs. The dehumanization of other races and other religions and other nations is part and parcel of, like, Western imperialism. So, you know, the brutality, there'll be nobody held to account. And these people will just basically get away with murder. And the victims and their families will never get any closure. And, you know, let's not forget what's happening in Yemen. Let's not forget what's happening in Syria and in Libya. This is happening all over West Asia and further afield.
Sure.
And the brutality that we witnessed in Ukraine as well from the fascists there. It's a mindset, and unfortunately, no one's held the account.
You mentioned a very key phrase there, Robert Frentina, and you said that this may be, or that this is, how orders have been handed from the top down, which is why it's executed by these special soldiers. And I found a sentence where it's interesting, where it said that it's the sort of violence that occurs in a war where brutality is encouraged from the top down. And then it went on to say Britain's whole occupation is built on it. Do you agree with that?
Yes, Britain has a long history as a colonial nation, over 100 years. And throughout its that colonial history, it's been very violent. Look what the British did in India and other places. So violence is always part of war. It's always part of colonialism and occupation. We can look at what the Israelis are doing to the Palestinians and have been for decades now. Violent, oppressive, cruel, really inhumane. And these are the components of war and of occupation. They simply come with the territory, and they are all criminal. They're all crimes against humanity. They're all war crimes. But countries, governments continue to perpetrate them, or perpetuate them, I should say, and we don't see them being held to account in really any circumstances whatsoever.
This not being held to account is what the problem is, which I believe leads to, if you agree, Farah Hughes, to this being committed on a repeated case. I mean, when you take a look at what has been revealed, where the UK was aware for years about these SAS soldiers and they're basically committing war crimes, but criminal investigations were closed without any prosecutions to be brought forward, then that kind of is a green light for them to continue it in any other war scenario or any other scenario. It may not even involve a war scenario. Why would years of reports actually not be investigated, do you think?
Well, I think there's several parts to this, and one of them would be that the British government does not want the British people to know what's being done in their name by their army and by their special air services. And the other one is, we in the north of Ireland have gone through our own kind of post-conflict amnesty. The British government last year actually brought into, or is bringing onto the statute books, a law that would give amnesty to war crimes carried out by British personnel over the 30 years of the conflict here in the north of Ireland. And it's been suggested that the amnesty would be more wide-ranging than the amnesty that was offered by Pinochet to cover human rights violations in Chile when he was in charge. And Queen's University in Belfast and the Committee for the Administration of Justice have both said that this amnesty proposed by the British government on behalf of the British armed forces would go much further than another 300 post-conflict amnesties. So what we have is not only no accountability and British soldiers being above the law, but now the law is going to be changed in order to protect them from war crimes. And if I was in Afghanistan, I would actually be bringing cases before the ICC, the International Criminal Court, in The Hague, rather than try and get justice from the British government when none will be forthcoming.
Well, we have a situation here, Robert Frentina, where it's pretty interesting. You have the UK Ministry of Defence that created what was called the and I'm going to move to another war scenario, and it's called the other war that the UK was involved in, which was based on the false premise of supposed weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, which that never turned out to be the case. They actually created a ministry called the Iraq, not a ministry, but a team called the Iraq Historic Allegations Team, where it looked into accusations of abuse committed by the British in Iraq now, between the years 2003 and 2006. And then they discovered some 280 victims of alleged unlawful killings and 1,235 cases of ill treatment, which included rape and torture. And then you have the government come up with a UK MP's committee, which said, you know what, that's not true, that can't be right. And they said it's an unstoppable self-perpetuating machine, deaf to the concerns of the armed forces, and that it had to be shut down. How do you explain that?
This is only explained by the fact that the UK government, like many or most other governments, doesn't want to be constrained in any way by going to war wherever they choose to go. And as your other commentator mentioned, they want their people to think of the military and members of the military as noble and going around the world to help people. This, of course, is a huge lie and a complete myth. They don't want them to know the savagery that these soldiers commit on a regular basis. Now, the fact that the UK established a committee, identified war crimes, crimes against humanity, and then simply, with the stroke of a pen, voided those findings is beyond appalling. The innocent victims receive no closure, there can be no compensation for loss of life. Nothing will compensate for that. But there's no accountability, and this just leaves the military, it gives the military free rein to commit whatever crimes it wants to in the future. So soldiers know from this that anything they do, they will not be held accountable for, and there's no limit to the cruelty they can inflict on their victims.
So let's take a look at some of the wars, and let's pick the two that really stands out, I think, for our Hughes, and the one in Afghanistan, obviously, and then, of course, the Iraq War. If you were to take a look at the way that the countries involved and their soldiers, how they acted in such a way, and I'm not talking about all of them, but obviously a portion of them that acted in the way that they did, where obviously violations of human rights was taking place at a minimum based on some of the ruling acts that have taken place, and I'm being very soft on calling it a violation of human rights. Didn't that contribute to the war itself to be lost and for the for there not to be a success, particularly, for example, when we take a look at Afghanistan, 20 years there, and you had UK soldiers, you had soldiers from ISAF, you had U.S. soldiers, but they didn't, as the one general once said, they wanted to win the hearts and minds, and they didn't. I believe it was the former General Flynn. It's because of these types of acts. Wasn't that a contributory to them not winning the war overall?
Yes, they've used violent repression in order to stop resistance. So what they've done is they've invaded against the will of the Afghan and Iraqi people. The people have reacted and resisted this foreign military intervention and occupation. And in order to stop and try to prevent the resistance, then they bring about more repression, more fear, more murders, more torture, more violence. And the more that they use that, the more people react. If you kill someone in cold blood who's innocent and unarmed, their brother, their friend, their son, it's not about revenge. People will just at some point say, this is not acceptable, and in order to stop this, we must make these foreign invaders leave our country. But the fact is that Britain and America and the other people involved in this, they tried hearts and minds here in Ireland as well. It's nothing more than propaganda, giving sweets to children, visiting people in hospital, trying to bring aid and succor and comfort to people in small communities. It's all PR, it's all propaganda, it's all a manipulation of the reality of what's happening on the ground. And, you know, from the day in our, any colonial power goes in and occupies any sovereign nation, there will always be resistance, and that resistance normally always wins. It's just a matter of time, be it 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, or in the case of Ireland, 800 years. But eventually, sure, people will fight and receive their freedom.
Indeed. Well, you have instances where, Robert Fintina, you have the accusations and then the proof that is out there, but yet the governments, the respective governments, don't want to follow through with the prosecution. In the case of the UK, since we've put some focus on that, even the ICC Court at The Hague has said hundreds of Iraqis, in terms of their testimonies, showed a pattern of beatings, sleep and sensory deprivation, stress positions, deprivation of food and water, sexual and religious humiliation, and what have you. Kind of sounds like a rap sheet for the American soldiers in Abu Ghraib and what they did there. So when this happens and so much time has gone by, doesn't this mean when the prosecutions are not there that there's a flaw in the system and that needs to be rectified? But then who do you go to do that? Because obviously these soldiers or whoever that's committing these war crimes are, they're immune to it. They're being shielded by the governments.
It's not a flaw in the system. The system is working the way the governments want it to work. They want to avoid and evade, push out the timeline investigation. Hopefully people forget. Hopefully the stories will, and then they can sweep these atrocities under the rug and commit them again. Now, these new investigation that has launched or is in early next year will be probably another show, some testimony given, some witnesses, and then minor findings may be determined or decided upon that there were some abuses here and there, but nothing that was typical. And then there might be one or two soldiers getting a slap on the wrist. But the people who are really responsible, the lead, held accountable, and they will be free, commit these crimes against humanity again and again and again, simply because, as I said, this is the way for the governments. They want this free reign to do whatever they choose in whenever they're involved in a foreign invasion, and holding people accountable for their crimes against humanity would constrain them. It's as it should work, but it's not how the governments want it to work, so they have set up the system so that there will be no accountability.
Sure. Well, I can't help but look back, as our guest there was talking, Frahis, and get your thoughts on what was called the Chilcot Inquiry, where you had the case of this, as I mentioned before, in terms of the false notion of WMDs in Iraq, and yet you have the former UK Prime Minister Tony Blair or the former US President George Bush Jr. who have walked scot-free and they've been responsible for so many deaths. And still the remnants of that war are echoing in the hospital chambers of people who are suffering from nuclear remnants from ammunition that was used, that was tainted with nuclear material. I mean, it's just something not right about this.
Yes, you're probably referring to the massacre in Fallujah where they used depleted uranium. I mean, Tony Blair, in my mind, he's a war criminal, and so is Bush. And all the deaths that occurred are all about foreign Western corporations going in and taking oil and gas and gold and whatever else it is that they took. And in Iraq, didn't they take millions, if not billions, of gold, pounds worth and dollars worth of gold bars that were in Iraq? And then on top of that, we can see through all this pain that still continues today. I mean, there's still landmines. There are still people losing their legs on a frequent basis in these countries from all the landmines that have been kind of abandoned all over the country in order to inflict further pain and torment kind of post-conflict after the war has been resolved. But there weren't only, you know, victims in Iraq and Afghanistan. You mentioned the Chilcot report, and it made me think straight away of David Kelly. David Kelly was the British scientist who was claimed to have sexed up the dossier in order to make it appear that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, which was the excuse used for the war. He walked off out into the woods near his home and didn't come back. They said he committed suicide. But in the film, The Killing of Kelly by George Galloway, there are persistent rumours that he was murdered. So the British government didn't just murder people in Iraq and Afghanistan. They quite possibly murdered a British scientist in order to cover up what he might have told any future inquiry as to how they came about with this whole notion of the weapons of mass destruction as an excuse to invade Iraq.
Sure. Looking down the road here, Robert Fantino, quickly, if you can answer this, are we looking at pretty much the status quo to continue, based on the fact that you're not getting the prosecutions that these cases deserve for any future endeavors in a war scenario that, in particular, the U.S. may be involved with, or the U.K., because usually they're work with this special relationship they have hand in hand.
Yes, and most of the wars on the planet do involve the United States in one way or another. And yes, sadly, we are going to see a maintenance of the status quo. There will be some, as I mentioned before, some minor findings from this current investigation, as there were from U.S. investigations about abuses in Iraq. But then the next war will see the same kinds of crimes, same kinds of cover-ups, and the same kinds of pseudo-investigations. When you have the British government investigating its own soldiers or the U.S. government investigating its own soldiers, that is not an impartial judge. There needs to be these things need to go to the ICC okay. So that they can be viewed impartially. Otherwise, we're going to see the same continually.
Thank you for that. We appreciate it, Robert Fantino, author and journalist. Frahis, thank you so much. Journalist, author, and activist. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Yacoba Tahoe and the team, it's goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Tawakkul comes from the root word wakala. Wakala means...
Today, I'd like to read to you an excerpt from...
Allah is the unique Arabic name.
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has decreed.
His decree, though...
Ya Rabba,
This is Foresight, a program on how to worship Allah. So, dear listeners, we are here humbly speaking about how we should make our heart a qibla to our tongue, and then we will see the beautiful benefits and the advantages that this has upon our ubudiyya, our servitude, our worship, and our obedience to Allah.